Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
What follows for the next 3 minutes is purely my opinion and not meant to be a psychiatric examination in any way, shape, or form. The most controversial pastor in America, Blaze TV, March 10th, 2024. People hate Doug Wilson more than they love Jesus. Right Response Ministries, January 10th, 2022. Pastor Doug Wilson is the Christian nationalist they warned you about. Tucker Carlson Network, April 15th, 2024. What do you do when you need to feel important in the world? How do you keep yourself in the news enough to make sure that dopamine hit never ends? If no one is talking about you, whether positively or negatively, do you matter anymore? The cottage industry you founded depends on negative press. Not unlike the liberal news that you decry. You long to be liked, to be loved, to be followed. Moscow, Idaho isn't enough. Being a small town pastor wouldn't do it for you. You crave the negative press. Your heart races when you're alerted about another hit piece in the news, a new podcast episode directed at you, another book chronicling your mission to Christianize the world. That means you can respond, and respond you do. If people cease being concerned about Doug Wilson, does he even matter anymore? You love the attention. Better yet, you love the following. It scratches that itch of affirmation that what you're doing matters, makes all the right people mad, and expands that little piece of internet real estate that'll be larger than your physical imprint will ever be. When you were younger, you were building, planning, pining, organizing, and training. If you deployed too early, if you were too brash too soon, it wouldn't grow like you needed it to. But now, it's growing faster than you anticipated. And that gives you anxiety, but like the controversy which surrounds you, it exhilarates you. Maybe you imagined your following would grow like this, and maybe you didn't. But one thing's for certain, it can't stop. Will it make people angry, fearful, reactive against you? Sure. But that's the price to pay when you're laying the groundwork for the next Christendom. This is the Lord's work, and there ain't no time for resting. Because you're not looking to 2024, or 2028, or 2032 for the fruition of your work. No. You've got much bigger plans and hundreds of years to build, but for what? You need followers and naysayers. You need the devoted few, kind of like Jesus, and the hundreds of thousands who keep you in the news for whatever you or your followers say or do. If no one hears your sermons, reads your books, or reacts to any of the foolishness of your following, will anyone remember you? Welcome to episode 2, The Apostle to the Patriarchs. Who is Doug Wilson? Who are his influences and why does that matter? We'll hear from a former professor of his, a former student, and a few others who've known him since he took over his church in the late 70s. But first, a message directed at Doug.
Doug, when you left our department after writing a very fine master's thesis on C.S. Lewis and the Freedom of the Will, the only thing that I asked you to do was to use that degree responsibly. And I have to say that you've not done that. You are an embarrassment to our department and the University of Idaho. And I just can't understand how you've changed in the way that you've changed. It really breaks my heart.
Who was that? I'll let him introduce himself.
I'm Nick Geyer, Professor Emeritus at the University of Idaho. I use that title rather than retired because Professor Emeritus is a lifetime title. I have all rights and privileges of a professor at the University of Idaho, except voting and faculty members meetings. I have a doctorate in philosophical theology from Claremont Graduate University. My major professors there, James Robinson, famous for the Gnostic Gospels, and John B. Cobb Jr., the world foremost process theologian.
Why is he so disappointed in Doug? To answer that, we need to go back to the 70s when Doug enrolled at the University of Idaho.
I had a class one day, first day of class, I think it was ethics, in the late 70s, early 80s. A very nice young gentleman came up after class and said, "Professor Geyer, I hope you don't mind, but I will be defending the faith in this class." And I said, "I don't mind at all. I look forward to the discussion." I like to joke now, and I didn't get a chuckle out of Doug when I sort of, this was the last time we had any interchange, was in 2007 on the U of I campus. I repeated that story and I said, "Well, Doug, it's pretty clear that if I had said no, there still would have been a defending of the faith, right?" And I was hoping that that would lend some humor to the conversation. It did not, and especially his students, his congregants, fellowship, Reformed Collegiate Fellowship. I was just trying to lighten the atmosphere a bit. From there on, he became a philosophy major in our course, in our department. He took every course that I offered, and he did very well in every course, I think. Got an A in every course except Buddhism. At the end of his undergraduate career, he was in such a hurry that he started challenging courses. And that means that you would go to the professor, get the syllabus, do all the reading, take all the exams, and essentially challenge the course without attending class. His exams in Buddhism were not up to his standard or my standard. He got a C in that course. But otherwise, very exciting student to have in class, very bright. And sometimes I think the other students were getting annoyed at the interchanges that we are having. But I enjoyed them. And at all times, the interchanges were civil and friendly. I considered him a friend until after a debate that we had on abortion in 1993. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I don't know if I told you this before, but after the debate, which was very lively, and I think I had some reservations about some of the things I didn't handle some questions in the Q&A very well, I didn't think. But otherwise, my position, I think I held it until just recently. But afterwards, Doug Wilson had a column in the local paper, and he repeated his position on the debate, the abortion debate, without telling anyone about how I rebutted and rejoined the debate. And I didn't take high school debate classes, but I do know that if you don't rejoin the rebuttals, you've lost the debate. All I drew from that is that I came to the conclusion that Doug Wilson was intellectually dishonest, and I gradually lost respect for him. And the real break happened with the publication or the discovery of the slavery book and the way that Doug Wilson handled the controversy about that booklet reaffirmed my position that he's intellectually dishonest and just like Trump, never backs down, never gives up. His position recently on the slavery booklet is that there were some stylistic issues with that. That's all there was. And we've fixed that, although they haven't republished that. And that black and tan would take care of everything else with that controversy. And of course, there was more than stylistic issues. He's had for 20 years every possible opportunity, for example, to say that I don't believe that the antebellum South was the greatest multi cultural and racial society in world history. He's had every opportunity to say, folks, I think I was wrong about that. No, just repeated defenses of everything that he said about slavery and other issues as well.
We'll get into the slavery booklet and its sequel, Black and Tan, in a bit. But first, I wanted to ask Nick, what kind of change did he see occur in Doug between the 70s through to his final interactions in the 2000s? Was Doug always a provocateur? Did anyone see the seedlings of later Doug in earlier Doug? And the big question is, why? Why the change? Why the development? A lot has to do with Doug's late father, Jim. You see, Doug wasn't the first militant minister in his family. He learned it from his dad. Moscow, Idaho has the perfect combination for the kind of impact a militant church can have. The state's flagship university, University of Idaho, and small population size, about 25,000. Doug shared that vision with his father and expanded it far beyond his father's wildest imagination, but he shared little else. His father had the idea, and Doug, the execution. But did Nick see this early on in his interactions with Doug?
The interesting thing, the more I think about this, is that I did not see anything in the student Doug that I now see.
Okay.
I don't know where this crawling over cut glass Calvinism came from. I think it came from Steve Wilkins. I think he learned his initial Reformed theology. I'm just guessing where he might have run across Reformed theology. I just don't recognize this person from my classroom days with him. And the intellectual dishonesty, I would have caught that in his papers, right? One time I challenged him to read Albert Camus' what's the name of his famous work? Boy, I'm just blank. And I said,
The Plague, is that Camus?
Not The Plague, but the famous book on suicide. I'm sorry, at 80 and a half, I'm just blocking on names and words.
The Stranger.
Not The Stranger. It's a philosophical work about
myth
suicide.
Myth of Sisyphus. That's the one.
The Myth of Sisyphus. Yep. Yes. Thank you so much. I've been talking about that with people recently. Yeah. And I said, Doug, just for an exercise, please read that book. It was assigned in our existentialism class. And take a different view of it. That is, write a critique from a non-Christian perspective, just as an exercise. And he did that. And I gave him an A on the paper. So that's why in the abortion debate, I gradually lost respect for him during the 90s. I just cut off communication. We had some email exchanges, but I just didn't want to interact with them anymore. The interesting thing is that I continued to have a friendship with his father, and in fact, I met his father before I met Doug, and we had a friendship until he just died recently, a couple of years ago. And maybe this is new material. I shouldn't say this if we're going to have a fresh start here. But we had several meetings. We had lunch over the years. About 10 years ago, I had lunch with him because I discovered his book on evangelical evangelism. Yep. And we talked about that. And I said, Jim, that upraised crusader sword on the cover is rather provocative. Do you regret, having that cover? And he said, oh, no, not whatsoever. I stand by that cover. I stand by what that means. That is, evangelism is like war. And we're using the strategies of warfare to evangelize. And something just caught my eye down the New St. Andrews has a new bookstore, and it's called The Sword and the Shield. And I said that it's that crusader mentality is still continuing there at hyper-masculine, warlike New St. Andrews College. But that was the last conversation I had with Jim. We were always friendly. I was always debating Bible passages with him, and considered him a friend until his death. I miss him. And one thing I say about Doug dropped everything and moved in with his father. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many weeks that was, but I admire Doug for that.
Yeah.
His father was a very strong influence in his life, and he always recognized that, acknowledged that from the very first days of God's garage in the early years in Moscow.
His father's idea, militant evangelism, combines with Doug's execution. Christ Church, Canon Press, New St. Andrews, the Logos Curriculum, Association of Classical Christian Schools, and on it goes. Theology that bites, and marketing that makes you uncomfortable in all the right ways. Doug was gearing up for a war no one else was aware of, because he was going to start it. But Doug's father wasn't a Calvinist. He was stunned Doug became one, let alone one who baptizes babies. That comes from Doug's specific theological trajectory, mixed in with a little bit of cultural ideology from a very specific sector within Christian circles, Christian Reconstructionism. Brian Morris profiles on a Twitter thread from February 18, 2024, about the connection between Marvin Alosky, Doug Wilson, and R.J. Rushdoony, the architect of Christian Reconstructionism. And it starts with one of the wealthiest men in America in the 1960s, Howard Amundson, and his death. And he leaves an estimated $300 million, about $3 billion in 2024 dollars, to his son, Howard Jr. His son then finds R.J. Rushdoony, that architect of Christian Reconstructionism, and we'll talk about that on a later episode, and he becomes a Reconstructionist himself. And he funds the Chalcedon Foundation. Alosky then meets the younger Amundson, the inheritor of the fortune and funder of Chalcedon, and Amundson offers Alosky the chance to edit and contribute to a huge 16-book series called Turning Points. Remind you of anything? Turning Point USA. Alosky reads Rushdoony for himself and at the very least gets cozy enough with Reconstructionism to publish it. Reconstructionism meets mainstream conservative evangelicalism. But back to Doug Wilson and Olasky's first notice of him. Doug opens a school, New St. Andrews, and publishing house, Cannon Press, in the early 90s, and he starts advertising on Marvin Olasky's World Magazine. Olasky takes notice and asks Doug to write a book on education, Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning. Doug and his wife, with a few friends, had started Lagos School with a corresponding homeschooling curriculum years before, and now Doug gets to publish about his experience. No formal education in pedagogy or curriculum design, but Doug's got access to a large and growing homeschooling movement, and you can say Olasky wants part of it. Doug Wilson is now an evangelical star, well before any reformed platforming by Ligonier or Desiring God. Doug railed against public education as his Reconstructionist forebears did, and R.C. Sproul Sr. is famous for doing so as well, though he was less explicitly tied to the Reconstructionist movement. But R.C. did commend Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning. Did I mention that Doug plagiarized and stole from Dorothy Sayers' Lost Tools of Learning, published about 50 years before? We will. And this was all before the slavery booklets hit the Moscow streets and lit the town on fire. The parallels are striking between the slavery booklets and the thought of R.L. Dabney, the 19th century Southern Presbyterian, ardent defender of Southern slavery, a Confederate believer, a proud racist, and the one who gave R.J. Rush Dooney all of his fire. Again, we'll dive into this in a later episode, Everything Reconstructionism. Doug was on the map in evangelical circles, but with the publication of the slavery booklet, he was now known in Moscow. You think Dougie didn't know what he was doing? He was a Reconstructionist, and now he's coming out as one. Here's Nick on the slavery booklets.
Yes, first of all, it was hundreds of people that contributed money to a full-page ad. And the title of the ad was Not in Our Town. And the implication was, we don't want neo-Confederate ideas in our town or defenders of slavery. The most interesting thing about that is that a church member, I was in contact with this church member, actually paid for a second publication of that ad. And, you know, I think it was a $1,500 ad, full page or whatever. So in those days, I had moles in the church. Not that I'd recruited them, but they contacted me. And it may have been the same person who bought the second ad, informed me about the plagiarized passages in the slavery book. But the thesis of the booklet was, Doug says he's not embarrassed by anything in the Bible, including many things that he would continue to affirm. But a good Christian, according to a straightforward reading of the New Testament, can hold slaves as long as he treats them humanely, something like that. So that the institution of slavery in the antebellum South was, page 24 in the slavery booklet, the most harmonious, multicultural, multiracial society in world history. So that's the thesis. And recently, especially in the town hall in April of this year, Doug is backtracking a little bit in confessing and admitting that horrible, horrible things happened in the South. And of course, that's true. Mm-hmm. One of the questions from the floor via the internet was the slave narratives that are housed in the Library of Congress, I guess. And we all know the horrible stories. And Doug said, well, those were, I guess, the bad Christians. A good Christian would not have mutilated slaves or impregnated them or something like that. So that was a little bit of an adjustment to the thesis of the slave theory. Mm-hmm. And just for the information of the general audience, Doug did remove the sale of the slavery booklet from Canon Press. But as I always tell people, there are thousands of copies of that book distributed around mainly in Doug Wilson's schools, maybe elsewhere, churches affiliated with Doug Wilson. It's still there. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote a book called Black and Tan.
Yep.
As a follow-up. And I've not studied it. I just was really tired of the whole issue.
Mm-hmm.
It is essentially a very arrogant attempt to respond to, why do I always block on the professor at the University of Washington, a professor, an expert in the antebellum South, Tracy. Why? I can get that to you. But anyway, he was a member of Doug's mission church in Seattle, and was very embarrassed by the slavery booklet, and verified the plagiarized contents. He knew the original book very well. And I just find it really amazing that Doug would not acknowledge and respect an expert on the South, in addition, a member of his own mission church in Seattle. But he took it upon himself to, rebut an expert at the antebellum South and make himself, an authority on slavery. That has always really amazed me. It's a sort of a sign of a Doug Wilson that I never knew, never even saw potential. He was I wouldn't say a humble man, but he was not an arrogant man in class. I've had arrogant students. So I'm really puzzled about the transformation that happened in Doug's character. And Jim's father was really very, very concerned about this. He told me that he met with Doug and his brother every Wednesday morning for prayer and breakfast, because his brother, Evan, had become totally estranged.
Mm-hmm.
From Doug. I don't think they've ever been reconciled. And Jim said, it's just really breaks my heart to see my two sons in this situation. And I think Jim also he could not understand why Doug had changed his theology to such a degree.
Yeah.
And I don't understand it either. And I may be totally wrong that it was Steve Wilkins, but that's the only link that I know of and could make any argument for.
What does Doug have to gain for coming out as a Confederate apologist? Moscow, Idaho isn't a conservative town. It's a college town. It's progressive. How does he think this flies there? What happened to the man who defended his faith in class in the late 70s and early 80s, who became good friends with his non-Christian professor, to now publishing vitriol of a racist flavor? Why did Doug publish this booklet? He swears he's not a racist, nor was he defending slavery per se, but why publish it when he did? You can summarize this in a quote. If no one hears about you, do you even matter? I bet Doug can't stand not being in the news and at the tip of tongues, whether that be in praise or with hate. So I asked Nick, why?
I think it was influenced by Steve Wilkins.
Okay.
I think it was his idea. And Steve Wilkins did most of the research. That's where the plagiarized passages come from. Doug, there's one more thing I admire Doug for, that even though the plagiarized passages came from Wilkins' research, Doug says, we are co-editors, co-authors. I take responsibility for these errors. Admirable. Mm-hmm. So I think Wilkins came up with the idea, handed all this research that he had done over, and they decided to co-author a book. And I don't know, I don't want to go back into it, who wrote what. What I've learned subsequently is that all sorts of people were giving me information at that time. Wilkins had two congregants in his church as, I think they were volunteers, his researchers. And they would pour over all sorts of material, and they were cut and paste material from their research and handed over to Wilkins. And it's real easy to see how a sloppy editor or author could, I mean, the plagiarism is so blatant that the subtitles are still there, right? Mm-hmm. You think that you would, you know, have your own subtitles or leave them out or something like that. So that's what I learned subsequently. So he was a serial plagiarizer. Doug Wilson would never do anything like that.
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah, he's a great writer. He's a very clever writer.
Yep.
The fluency of his writing is amazing. And he would never take any other person's words except his own. So it's definitely Wilkins' fault.
Publicity is the dopamine of leaders. Your brand is not controlled by the press. It's launched by them. How do you get a talent to both hate you and know you at the same time? You publish a steaming hot mess of Civil War propaganda. Whether you believe everything in it or not, that's not the point for you. It's what it does. That's what you're after. Because you know when those liberals next door happen upon a booklet, they'll notice you. Sure, they'll despise you. They'll spew whatever hate-filled speech they can think of your way. But at least they know you. A church that's known for something, you might think, is better than not being known at all. You weren't looking for neo-Confederates, whether you fashioned yourself one or not. You were thinking downstream. I'm on the map. What did Moscow know of Doug Wilson before? Did they even know him before? Nick Geyer again.
Well, I've been here for 52 years. Came in 1972. And I don't think anyone outside of me and maybe some other people familiar with the evangelical churches in town knew about Doug Wilson until the slavery booklet. Mm. So it's been only 20 years that the general population of Moscow has been aware of his presence and his activities. Now, people in the church, evangelical church community, would have known him from first founding Logos School.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, there was a controversy there. It seemed to be smoothed over, and you may have some information about this, that he, I think, was removed from the board or took a minor sort of role in administering the school so that all the evangelicals in the area would be happy sending their children there. Now, I think even before the slavery booklet, this is a very almost the same time, Doug came to the city council for a permission to have New St. Andrews downtown.
Mm-hmm.
It had originally started in houses in the neighborhood Even then, he was breaking city rules about having churches in town. And they were able to get a conditional use permit for a new St. Andrew's College. I remember having a conversation with Doug outside of that hearing. We just happened to be at the refreshment table at the same time. And we just said hello. At that time, I was not wanting to be that friendly with Doug. But he said, I don't think he cursed, but he said, I didn't want any conditions for the permit. Of course, the city could not grant that to him.
Yep.
They had told the University of Idaho that they couldn't be downtown. So that was rather arrogant for him to think that he could get full permission to have New St. Andrews downtown. But that was in the news. And he's been in the news ever since. And New St. Andrews has moved across the street, bought an art gallery there. And they said, we're not breaking the conditional use permit because there will be no teaching over there. We'll have some administrative offices upstairs, and we will have our own art gallery. And more recently, Doug Wilson was at a meeting asking that one of the main roads into one of his developments, there are Christchurch developments all over town now. Mm-hmm. He said, I'd like to have this main road called Dominion Way. And there were a few people in the audience who were prepared for this, and they piped up and said, that is a theological term. That means that Doug wants to take over the government or take over the town. I don't know what committee it was, but they said, go ahead. It's okay. You can call it Dominion Way. I'm just trying to be very calm and good Buddhist meditative pose about this so-called takeover of the town. It is happening. And I'm just going to speak out when I need to about this. And I'm going to stay in town. I'm going to hold my ground. Mm-hmm. It's going to be gradual. But it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So Jim Wilson's target, nothing big like Spokane, nothing little like Louisville out in the countryside, Moscow Pullman, perfect targets for evangelical evangelism or what, yeah, whatever it is.
Dominionism, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a good time to bring up a protege of Doug Wilson, the former pastor of Mars Hill Church, Mark Driscoll. I've got personal history with him myself, being caught in the snare of the hyper-masculinity and young restless reform movements of the late 2000s, early 2010s. I was looking for strength in the midst of my perceived weakness, and I found a leader who personified it. So let's play a clip that acted like Mark Driscoll's own slavery booklet, what really put him on the map. At the very least, it's how I and many other men my age in college trying to figure out who they were, how they found Driscoll.
Some of you guys, it's so frustrating. Some of you guys have been coming here for years. You still got your hands all over your girlfriend. Some of you guys, they're coming here for years. You're still not praying with your wife. Some of you guys have been coming here for years. You're still single and having sex. Some of you guys will even as I'm preaching the sermon, some of you will be sitting next to your girlfriend or your fiance or your wife. Some of you guys have already given her that look. Don't cry. Don't let them know they're talking about me. Just hold it together. You've already intimidated her right here. Some of you guys have already whispered in her ear, I don't want to hear it. We're not talking about this in the car on the way home. Some of you have already whispered in her ear, I'm sorry, I'll do better. Trust me, let's just move on real quickly. How dare you? Who in the hell do you think you are? Abusing a woman, neglecting a woman, being a coward, a fool, being like your father, Adam. Who do you think you are? You are not God. You are just a man. You're not an impressive man. You're not a responsible man. You're not a noble man. You're not a respectable man. You're not a responsible man in any regard. I don't care how successful you are. In this area, if you are a failure, it clouds all of your dignity. It robs all of your masculinity. There is no excuse for any man who claims the name of Christ to treat a woman in a dishonorable, disrespectful way. Some of you right now, you guys will get all angry. Oh, how dare he yell at me? That's the Holy Spirit telling you, it's you. I didn't name you, he did. You change now. Little boy, you change right now. You shut up, you put your pants on, you get a job, you grow up, and maybe one day you can love a woman. It's for men, not for boys. And those of you men who are here and your wives are suffering under your folly and failure, shame on you. And shame on you if you say you're a Christian. And shame on you if you've been attending Mars Hill. And shame on you if you've been surrounded by good men and have pursued none of them. And shame on you if you've not become a member and submitted to spiritual authority. And shame on you if you've not joined a community group so you can walk in darkness. And shame on you if you show up to put communion in your hands, representing the body and blood of your murdered Savior. And then go put them on your girlfriend or download porn from the internet or raise your hand in a threat to your wife.
For Wilson, it was slavery. For Driscoll, it was yelling. Different strategies pursued towards the same end, notoriety. And if you haven't heard that clip, I guarantee you know someone who has. Sure, Wilson and Driscoll may try and explain why they did and what they did, but the booklet and the screaming are highly effective strategies of putting yourself on the map. A booklet circulating in a small town gets around fast, and the news shortly thereafter. The rise of smartphones, social media, and video streaming allowed Driscoll the ability to go viral when few had even heard of the term. I don't know if Driscoll was aware of Wilson's slavery booklet, and I couldn't tell you what he'd think of them, but what I can tell you is that Wilson was a spiritual father of Driscoll in a time when the rise and influence of Calvinism was growing in American evangelicalism. When they started, the two were pastors of non-denominational churches with Calvinistic influences. One was brash of tongue, the other was brash of the page. Driscoll's sermons on family and marriage were near carbon copies of Doug's. If you read Wilson on Men and Leadership, you are prepped, groomed even, for Driscoll, who preached it with a level of rhetorical flair Wilson just doesn't have. And here's an example of what I'm talking about. Doug Wilson talking with Mark Driscoll on a Canon Press YouTube clip from September 22nd, 2011.
I wanted to have the first section of our questioning key off of something you said in this last talk on masculinity. You said that the largest demographic group in your church is single males in their 20s, and you used a phrase that was quite striking to me. You said you've gone after that group.
Intentionally focus.
How? How have you gone after that?
There's a whole bunch of variables. You know, the number one issue they find statistically of why a man chooses a church is who the senior leader is. Guy walks in and is like, I'll follow that guy.
Driscoll found his leader in Doug Wilson, though they differed on a few points theologically. But the important point is the patriarch created a disciple in his own image. Wilson the writer and Driscoll the preacher. Wilson was influenced by Christian Reconstructionism, Southern Presbyterians, Confederates for the most part, and the classical tradition of education. Driscoll was influenced by the emerging church, Seattle grunge, and old music set to new tunes. Though you probably couldn't get two more opposite personalities in a room together, they both shared the same goal. We need more patriarchs. Driscoll rose to fame in one of the most progressive cities in the world, with a population roughly 30 times that of Moscow. Driscoll had to be more brash to get coverage. Wilson had to be cunning. Let me introduce you to someone who witnessed the rise of both. We'll get back to Nick shortly.
I'm Russell Moore. I'm editor-in-chief of Christianity Today. Before that, I was president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the public policy arm of the SBC. And before that, I was provost and dean and professor of theology and ethics at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. I don't know Doug Wilson. I've never met him personally. I don't think I've ever had any conversation with him at all, even at the level of an email that I can remember. Everything that I know about Wilson is both in terms of his public presence and also then the ripples that are sent out from his movement, which I do know quite well, having seen that affect evangelical Christianity quite a bit. I think the first time I was ever familiar with Doug Wilson would be when I was in seminary in the early to mid 90s, reading a magazine that he put out called Credenda Agenda.
Yep.
And the reason I became familiar with that, I was one of the at the time very few of us. We were all seminary students or the equivalent who were Reformed-ish in the SBC, which at the time was very strange. A lot of us kind of looking for an alternative to revivalist Bible Belt Southern Baptist life, something more substantive, more historically rooted. And someone had sent me along a there was a column in Credenda Agenda called The Cave of Adullam that had just short sort of sarcastic kind of musings on things. So I started reading Credenda Agenda after that. And then I disagreed with a lot of it. even at the time, it was post-millennial, kooky, sort of KJV only, Texas Receptus only, type stuff. And so a lot of it was kind of, can you believe they're actually arguing this? But there were some things that I thought were good critiques of kind of consumerist evangelicalism at the time. And it was funny.
Satire.
Really,
yep. He's known for satire. Yep.
Yeah. So it was almost like a combination of a theological treatise with the old Wittenberg Door, kind of what later became Babylon Bee, that kind of thing, all in one package. So that's where I first became familiar with him. I remember he did a panel of some sort with John Piper.
Yep.
At, I don't even remember which of the conferences. There were so many.
It was 2000. We have one that's 2009, another one that's 2013, something like that.
This would have been earlier than that.
Oh, okay.
Because what they were talking about was Piper said in the panel.
Yeah.
That he read Credenda Agenda the same way that he read First Things, which was, as everyone read First Things at the time, which was to go right to the back to see Richard John Newhouse's section. Gotcha. That he read that and that he found it very dangerous because it was so acerbic and sarcastic.
Here's the clip that Dr. Russell Moore was referring to.
People are thinking about the excellence of your rhetoric. That's a lousy paraphrase. Now, Doug Wilson is absolute genius at sarcasm. and irony. And I would just wave a little yellow flag to the effect that you come away from these articles thinking, oh, this is what the quote said. You can't exalt Christ and commend yourself as clever. You're very clever, really clever. And I think we need you like crazy. I read Cadenda Agenda, and I wouldn't waste my time on it if I thought it was only contaminating. But I tell you, I can OD on it fast because it is so well done from a rhetorical standpoint. So just a little warning that I think there need to be more obvious tears in Credenda Agenda. More obvious tears. Jeez, the one illustration I would give is, don't clap about that. You don't need to do that. Here's the illustration. Jesus is in the synagogue.
And so he was doing kind of, which Piper always did. Piper always would kind of insult his hosts or his guests in some way or the other. He used to do that every time he came to Southern. He would lambaste us for how nice the facilities were, that kind of thing. So he said that, and Piper said, and after he said that, Wilson responded, well, you just need to know, John, every time you read that and you think that I'm holding back. So it was this big laugh line. So that those would have been my earliest sorts of memories of Wilson.
The mid-90s witnessed the rise of both Driscoll and Wilson, with Driscoll pacing his forebear in the 2000s and Wilson not far behind in the 2010s. One thing Russell notes is the rhetoric of Wilson, which he compares to his nearest analog, Mark Driscoll. Russell continues.
Well, I saw it with Wilson pretty early on, not in terms of the sexual sort of coarseness that would come along later, but in terms of what seemed to be an intentional effort to shock in a particular kind of way, not in order to arrest people's attention and sort of get them out of preconceived notions. I mean, that's a teaching mechanism Jesus does that too. It was more along the lines of, it seemed to me, to get people to feel as though they were part of the bad kids in the classroom. That sort of a vibe was present really really early on with Wilson, and then started to accelerate. I had a pastor say to me one time, he said, look, here's the problem with, he agreed with a lot of what Wilson recommended in terms of marriage, parenting, kinds of things. He said, the problem is I can't give out Doug Wilson books because even when it's 90% sort of straightforward counsel, there's 10% of it that's just howling at the moon crazy. And intentionally so. And by that, he wasn't even talking about some of the things that I would say are crazy. He was talking about, I think he used the example, you have you have an extended discourse on how to raise boys that includes a section on legalizing drugs or something like that, which I think he saw as unintentional, that Wilson's crazy was kind of showing itself through. I think it was intentional, and I think there's a parallel with what we saw later with Driscoll and with Trump.
Yep.
And so they had a lot of what would happen with Driscoll is that people would say, he just accidentally said something that's really offensive and shocking. Well, he wasn't accidentally doing that. He is intentionally doing that because he knows that as long as you have people who are standing around saying, can you believe what Mark Driscoll said?
True.
Then they're saying Mark Driscoll. And I think that was very much in his interest. Not to mention the fact that there was a dynamic. I remember hearing from a pastor who was talking about some young men in his congregation who had become really enamored with Driscoll. And one of the reasons for that is they said he gets up in our grill.
Yep, that's exactly why I started following Driscoll myself.
Yeah, and so they would say, they would go on Saturday nights, I think, and listen to him lambaste them for watching porn and yep. mistreating their girlfriends and whatever.
Yeah.
And then it was almost this kind of catharsis. So I can go and I can get beaten up on, and then I can have the experience of sort of, it almost played the role that indulgences played in the medieval church. Okay, now I can start over again. It's like a confessional, except I'm getting beaten up. And with Wilson, you had some of that. I'm going to come in and tell you what losers you are. But unlike with Driscoll, followed by wink, wink, but we're not the losers, they are. And usually it's women. And so we're part of the club here. So you had that kind of psychological dynamic that I think was really, really important here. The coarseness, I'm not sure when that started developing to the degree that it did. But you look at the parallel with Trump, is that a lot of people, especially on the outside world, will assume, okay, the people who are hardcore Trumpists in evangelical world are sitting down and making this kind of calculation, which is to say, I don't like this, but I'm going to get these certain things. And there were some of those people, but not nearly as many as people think. For a lot of people, there had been this habituation of a kind of entertainment, professional wrestling sort of interest, where what someone is looking for in the leader is sitting on the edge of your chair. What's he going to say that's going to really be shocking here? So you saw that in kind of the Pentecostal prosperity gospel world with your Kenneth Copelands and your Joyce Meyer. I think there's a lot of parallel between Joyce Meyer and Doug Wilson, because Joyce Meyer is, whatever else she is, she's a really skilled stand-up comedian. And she's a particular kind of stand-up comedian where part of the laugh comes from this sense of unexpected, I can't believe she just said that, sort of thing. Wilson does that too. He just does it in his, he does it with a with his particular subculture. Yep. But it's the same dynamic, and Trump really perfected that well. And so you're able to feel as though the reason that people don't respect me the way that I think they ought to respect me is because they're awful. And I'm with a group of people where we can laugh at that. And I think that gives a certain kind of community to people.
What we saw early on with Wilson, we witnessed later with Driscoll and then with Trump. Well, who do you think Driscoll learned it from? Driscoll pastored a church in the same region, followed a similar theological trajectory, and he taught similarly on marriage and family and targeted the men, the patriarchs. Wilson's rhetoric was with a pen, Driscoll's with his sermons. Wilson, though, was not nearly as gifted orally as Driscoll, and Driscoll doesn't have anything close to Wilson's writing ability. What they both excelled at, though, was subversive speech. Because in order to grow your tribe, you have to rile them up. If you can just say enough to get the media mad at you, you know your audience grows exponentially. And when the world watches, your churches grow, no matter how quick the criticism comes. But back to Nick. For someone so tender and soft-spoken, you might be wondering, how did he ever get along with Doug? How does someone who's grown so opposed to everything Doug stands for ever strike that relationship up in the first place? For a professor to still care this much about his student, there's got to be some baseline respect. How did Nick and Doug become friends in the first place? The professor with the disgraced patriarch.
I think we had mutual respect for one another in the classroom and outside the classroom. That started to fade, like I said, in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we still recognized each other as honorable opponents.
Mm-hmm.
In that 2007 interchange, it was still civil. There was no rancor. I pressed him on a few points. My main issue going to that meeting was that I had heard that Doug preached that it was okay to lie to spread the gospel. And we started with Rahab's lie in the Old Testament. Peter, you gave me the reference there. I'd never known exactly.
Yep. Joshua 2. Yep.
Yeah. And what I regret now not doing at the end of our talk about that was that Rahab's lie was contingent upon a situation that is to get the spies in or whatever the story was. And Doug had continued that frame of reference to lying to the Gestapo to save a Jew if you were harboring a Jew in your house. But I regret now not really finishing that argument. Those are all prudential acts. They were prudent in the moment, but you would never recommend lying as a policy. And it seems like from the pulpit, Doug Wilson was making lying to spread the gospel as policy, not at all analogous to Rahab or saving a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the last. And that conversation was just like we had conversations in class. It was respectful. I could see that his students, who were the students who had hosted that class, were getting restless. I think they were thinking that, oh, Geyer is, getting the best of our pastor. I don't think that was. Maybe I could have got the best of him if I'd finished my argument, but they were getting restless. I wanted to continue the discussion. I think Doug wanted it too, but the student host got up and said before the 9 o'clock hour that the meeting had ended.
Like Driscoll's get on the bus or get run over, we've got a pile of bodies behind the bus. Wilson's is, you don't like my rhetoric? You probably wouldn't like Jesus's, and you certainly wouldn't like the prophets. He gives himself a certain amount of authority to say what he wants, however he wants to say it. Why? Because he's the apostle. He's the head honcho. He gives the marching orders. Our culture is weak, our vocabulary is soft, and our pulpits are ineffective. We've got men being ordered by women, men serving women, and women leading the households and our government. If we don't use strong language, masculine language, subversive language, we're not going to right this ship, and America is going to drown. The figurehead needs power. He needs authority. He needs eyes. What used to take every few years for Wilson has been shortened to every few weeks. The more often you take the drug, the more your body needs to satisfy that same craving. Wilson isn't capable of staying out of the spotlight anymore. That thing he used to deride. He was the anti-evangelical for so long, but now he craves it. Driscoll grew quick, reached his peak, and fizzled fast. Yes, he was rising again, but just wait a little while for another fall. But Doug is strategic, remember that? Doug does nothing quickly. His words are measured. His actions, calculated. He's thinking generations from now, where the future patriarchs continue his legacy when he's long gone. Thinking long term, for someone who's known Doug as long as Nick has, what's his advice for those who want to follow in their teacher's footsteps?
Well, of course, I would say, don't come here. He is a con man. I might come up with a different word for that. He's deceitful. And let me, if I can take a little time here, I'm in the paper and I've got my email. So I wrote two responses to the town hall meeting and I had my email right there. A woman emailed me and said, I would really like to have you over for Sunday afternoon. I've got some serious things I want to ask you about. Her daughter was once married to a Christchurch man. A Christchurch man who had spent 2 years in prison for statutory rape. And I think she knew that before she married them, but it ended in divorce. And this woman says, at least my daughter gets the kids on alternate weekends and we go to the Catholic church. But I'm really worried about when the kids are at Christ Church. And of course, Christ Church and St. Andrews have had statutory rapists as well as pedophiles. And I guess she's worried about pedophilia. And it was a very moving afternoon talking to her and her deep, deep worry about her grandkids and what she should do. And I've always been a member of the Unitarian Church and still go there, of course. And the Unitarian Church is a refuge for a lot of families that have concern about what their children are going to be exposed to. And that's all I could really recommend, is that she seek counsel with people that I trust. But it was just a very sad afternoon to learn that she says, I can't sleep. I don't know what's going to happen to my grandchildren when they're with that other family.
It doesn't have to be this way. We shouldn't want men following other men or women following other women. The Apostle Paul himself says, follow me as I follow Christ. We follow not a master who's building an empire, but the servant who gave himself up for you and I on the cross. Jesus came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. The patriarch demands respect. Jesus earned it. I get it if you've left the church because of someone like Doug or because of Doug himself. I understand if the church is the apex of the patriarchy in your mind, if the men rule and the women drool, when the men are geared more for war than they are for service, when the women are feared more than cherished. You see, Wilson isn't the problem, he's the symptom. Our culture longs for love and acceptance in the midst of a competition for likes and downloads, wherein the extreme is the norm and the norm is the extreme. We need pastors who seek to build up others, not themselves. Those whose speech is not aimed to shock and awe and maybe drum up a bit of disgust, but whose speech paints the picture of the glories of Christ. Because that dopamine doesn't last. Those clicks will never be enough, and fame is but a fickle friend and a maniacal master. A pastor whose archives include those of his controversies, guess what? They're looking for more controversies. Because if there are no more controversies, that means no one's looking. We're not seeking to add to the Doug Wilson controversy list, or better known as Doug Wilson derangement syndrome, but when you're looking at Doug, this is who you're seeing, not what he wants you to see. He is but part of a movement, a leader, if not the leader, to be sure, that will far outlive him if we don't figure out what's going on and what their plans are. This isn't about Trump, nor is it simply about politics. It's about a way of life, seeing our world, understanding our culture and those around us. It's separating everything into us and them, or us versus them. It's about building a new Babel. And that new Babel is called Christian nationalism. And that's where we're going next. Sons of Patriarchy is brought to you by the administrators of Examining Doug Wilson in Moscow in partnership with Peter Bell. It's written, produced, and edited by Peter Bell. Original music, sound design, and mixing by Aaron Feeney. This series wouldn't be possible without the dozens of abuse survivors whose bravery and vulnerability make it what it is. Every episode was sent to them before being published, and their feedback, edits, encouragement, and eventual approval make this what it is. May your voices be heard far and wide. Thank you.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.